Good morning and welcome. It's Friday. It's 11. It must be Ask the Pastor. KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thanks for being with us. Congratulations. I don't know how you feel about Fridays. Sometimes you're tempted to say it's not Friday until 5. No, I don't know about that. Friday is just fun. Remember, only 2 days till Monday. There's a cheery thought for you. Joining us this morning is Pastor Paul Heneke from Luther Memorial Lutheran Church in Tinton Falls, New Jersey, way up in the great Northeast. How are you, my friend?
Very good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. What's going on up in Jersey?
Well, we're doing all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's a beautiful day, which is good. And, you know, life is always good in New Jersey. It's starting to come back together again after Sandy. And although there's still a lot of recovery efforts that are ongoing with people, and folks are a little nervous about the summer and what's going to happen. And
well, how close, in proximity, how close were you to all the, I mean, the really intense damage that was done by Sandy?
Well, the really intense damage was actually probably about 6 miles from here. We're about 6 miles inland.
So it's in the neighborhood?
It's in the neighborhood.
Wow.
And we had three or four families that were significantly impacted. And so we've been able to help them. And I tell you, the response of the church at large has been extraordinary. I mean, there's a lot of resources were poured in and a lot of things happened, particularly with two congregations that are kind of coordinating that in a very big way, one in Point Pleasant and then the one in Lenoka Harbor. And they're talking about, you know, I mean, hundreds of man hours that have gone into stuff. And
well,
we've provided
imagine,
some
yeah.
volunteers, and we've, you know, money and stuff that's coming from all over the country. So been very, very generous.
Now, I don't mean for this to be a political question, because it isn't. It's just a question about the media. But when you compare that to, you know, what happened with the hurricane in the Gulf under a previous administration,
right.
The press has forgotten about you.
Pretty much.
How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, it's other things overtake that, it's in many ways it's gone pretty well. I mean, in terms of some of the terrible things that happened, in the South, did not happen here, but yet there's still people who are really hurting, and. My observation is that the response of the church at large, not only Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but other churches as well, has really made a difference in a lot of people's lives, which is really, for me, the most important thing, that it really gave us an opportunity to help people.
I don't know if you had a chance to meet with one of my pals, Pastor Tim Engel, with the Comfort Dogs.
No, I did not. They were down in Point Pleasant. I know that our urban mission strategist, Jim Buckman, was down both at Point Pleasant and at Lenoka Harbor doing some stuff with them on prayer and how to solicit prayers and what to do with the prayers after you get done, which is his specialty, and which is area of ministry. But I know that that was just a tremendous thing. People are shattered when that kind of stuff happens. I mean, you just watch them. They're just shattered. And any little bit of help that they receive is received gratefully, but there's been more than a little bit of help. It's been a whole bunch of stuff that has happened, which has been really wonderful.
So have you had to encounter, I mentioned in the last hour, this story that was on the wires today about a fella who was going parachuting, and his first chute didn't open, and the emergency chute didn't open, and he survived the impact of hitting the ground, and the press was asking him, you know, what were your thoughts on the way down? And he says, you know, God must really hate me. Did you have to encounter a lot of that in your ministry with this kind of destruction?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's times that that's one of the. I think a lot of times when people are hurting or scared or frightened, they do think in terms of what did I do to deserve this, you know, or why doesn't God like me? The reference movie for me is always Bruce the Almighty. You know, where you got that, you know, the Jim Carrey character and Jennifer Aniston going back and forth about, you know, she's saying, well, you need to pray about that, and then the response that always I think is very real is that, well, I can do that, but God's not going to listen to me because he's too busy giving whatever the other guy's name was everything he wants. So You know, it's that old Psalmist question. You know, why do the wicked prosper?
Yeah.
And so once you begin to operate in a universe in which it all depends on us, and it depends on, you know, our pleasing God or our making God happy or whatever those things are, then you've just wandered off the trail of grace and have lost sight of the larger issues of life, which is, you know, what am I going to do with my life? How is God using me to serve the larger purposes?
Well, yeah, that's something that, you know, I spent a few minutes talking to Dr. Steinbrunn, Reverend Dr. Tony Steinbrunn, the president of your district.
Yes,
up there.
My good friend.
Yeah, I told him, I said, the next time they have an election, sit closer to the exit.
Yeah, right.
I bet you're keeping him busy as well.
Yeah.
He's a good friend. And
he's a wonderful guy. He does tremendous work. I think he's a real gift to the church as a thinker and as a person who is a little bit ahead of us on some stuff that we talk about things. So.
Well, I guess early in his career it was missionary work. He was called
into
Africa. Yeah.
And some of those, you know, I think that this is kind of really important when you start to think about that, is that him and several others like Bob Newton, and who was also a missionary, are beginning to understand and communicate to the church that for many of us, we are operating in a mission field. And it's not that much different from some of the other places in the world. I was looking at some statistics this morning. We got our big voters meeting coming up on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And we're looking towards the future and stuff like that. And looked at some demographic numbers. And one of the more interesting demographic numbers that we get from this Mission Insight outfit is that when it talks about religiosity, within a five-mile radius of Luther Memorial, which is encompasses a lot of people, the religiosity is extremely low. And only one out of six within that survey area thinks that faith is really important.
Well, yeah, that's the one thing I would say. You know, folks talk about how the mission field in the United States is similar to places like maybe in Africa. I think maybe there's more faithful people in Africa than we have right now.
I think in many ways you still have a society which is more attuned to spiritual things. I mean, this part of the universe is pretty secular. When you start looking at that stuff, it's pretty secular. And it's not even on radar screen, you know. It's more of a kind of a Stephen Hawking world, you know, that we have outgrown our need for God.
Well, that's from our lesson that we had in Luke today, chapter 12, the fellow with the barns.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, life is good.
Life is good.
it's all up to me.
Yeah.
There's I've got a story here that I pulled out of I think it was the Christian Post that talks about it says, "In God we trust," that's the headline, "more Americans than ever profess to having no religious preference." And I think that's a misnomer. We all have a religious preference, don't we?
Well, yeah, this might be none.
Well, but then that would really be self, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's why I'm always saying that, you know, life is theology, because when you see a headline like this, profess having no religious preference at all, well, that's First Commandment stuff.
Right. It goes back to the Garden of Eden. Be your own God.
Yeah.
You know, you can decide for yourself what's right and wrong. All that relative language that's out there today, and all those kinds of things. And where we are here is, this is a very secular place. It really is. So
why should you care? You've got your congregation. Things are doing okay. So what? Let them believe what they want.
Right. I mean, that's the temptation. And the temptation, I think, is maybe not quite that crass, but...
Well, I've actually had conversations with people that went just that way.
But we may be able to phrase that in a gentler way.
Yeah.
That says that maybe what we need to do is just try to hang on and try to preserve what we have and build the wall higher and just kind of tuck in and hope that we are able to survive until in some cases, quite literally, until Jesus returns, you know.
Yeah.
That,
505-7850-1800-730-2727 and KFUO at KFUO.org. Works from anywhere in the world, even New Jersey, I'm told.
That's true.
Hey, there's another story. I pulled this off of an English newspaper, the Daily Mail Online. The headline is, Shape-Shifting Jesus Spent His Last Supper with Pontius Pilate. Now, does it not shock you that this story comes out, just a couple of weeks before Easter?
Well, that's the secularization of where we live. You know, just that anything that you can say is okay. You can even make it up, you know.
Yeah. It's an old Egyptian manuscript that was a Coptic manuscript, 1,200 years old, finally translated in totality, that offers up, according to the story, some plot twists, including a revelation that Jesus was a shapeshifter. The ancient illuminated texts claim why Judas used a kiss to betray Jesus was because only he knew what shape he may be having at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they couldn't just pick him out, because it goes on to say here, let's see, trying to find where they quote it. It claims that on the night before the crucifixion, Jesus ate dinner with Pontius Pilate, the Roman prefect who decided his sentence, who, it is said, remarkably offered his own son to be crucified in the place of the Messiah. Jesus declined the offer, explaining that if he could escape from his fate, he could escape from his fate if he wanted to. Pilate then looked at Jesus, and behold, he became incorporeal, and he did not see him for a long time. Yeah. This is, what, one of those old ancient Gnostic Gospels, I would guess.
I would think so, yeah. Late, you know, I mean, it's what, 1,200 years old, so that's the church is already,
yeah,
you know, 800 years old by that point.
You know, what's interesting is this talk about reimagining or mm-hmm. rethinking the Bible. Is this mm-hmm. where you wind up when you start rethinking stuff?
Yes, I think so. I think you end up, what you end up with is taking, you know, all of these fragments and all of these things that are out there, and putting them all on the same level.
Yeah. Now, of course, they have to throw in the obligatory line, however, since the papyrus emerged last November, scholars have queued up to cast doubt on its authenticity.
Well, that could be. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert in ancient stuff, but shape-shifting seems to be more of a modern notion.
Yeah, that's more Harry Potter stuff, I think.
That's right, yeah, that seems to be more.
Here's another quote from it. This is a quote from the papyrus, as translated. The Jews said to Judas, "How shall we arrest Jesus? For he does not have a single shape, but his appearance changes. Sometimes he is ruddy, sometimes he is white, sometimes he is red, sometimes he is wheat-colored, sometimes he is pallid like the ascetics, sometimes he is a youth, sometimes an old man." Pretty bizarre stuff.
Yeah, that's
you know, this is what happens when you live in a cave in the Syrian desert for a long time.
Probably. I think this stuff up. You know? But again, it's almost modern in the sense of, I mean, I can see people sitting in Starbucks reading that stuff and saying, well, yeah, I understand that, you know, Jesus can be anybody.
Well, I have to confess that when I was a grade schooler,
yeah.
You know, back in the 70s, early 70s, this fellow named Erich von Däniken was very popular, and his book Chariots of the Gods.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, but I was a kid who was fascinated by the space program, so that's mm-hmm. what drew me in. But, yeah, that was, you know, Quetzalcoatl and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Let's go to the phones real quick and talk with Jan. Jan, good morning. You're on with Pastor Haneke. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. And, you know, I love God's Word because it speaks to every aspect of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
When in Deuteronomy 18 it says that if what a prophet prophesies does not come true, that's an indication of the fact that that's a false prophet.
Right.
And then earlier in Deuteronomy 13 it says if what the prophet does comes true, and then he says, let's go follow some other god, gods mm-hmm. that you have not known.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that God is the one true God, and he's the only one that can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that scripture tells us that God is testing you to really show you that you love him wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So if if what he says doesn't come true, or if what he says isn't about Christ, he's a false prophet.
Yes, that's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
We have any number of interesting topics that we can discuss, but it must always be in light of what God has said.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking a lot about suffering recently,
mm.
and I'd like your thoughts on a couple of passages.
Sure.
It's three.
Three?
Yes.
Okay.
The first one is Job 37, verse 13, and I'm looking in the English Standard Version.
Well, that's good, because so am I.
Oh, good. Because the reason I made that distinction is I looked at it in the NIV, and it wasn't threefold like it is in the
mm-hmm.
ESV.
Yeah, right.
Isaiah 57, verse 1.
Okay.
Starting at verse 1. And then finally, Psalm 107.
Okay.
I'm a woman,
mm-hmm.
and that's confusing to some people on the phone. But I'm not just a woman. I'm a mother, a wife.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like I can turn any of those things off. So it really puzzles me when people suggest that it's impossible for Jesus to be fully God and fully man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a doctrinal kind of a thing. It's the great exchange that Luther talks about. You know, this idea that the church has always struggled with that notion. You know, that, and the heresies have gone in two directions. Either the, sometimes in the life of the church, the idea of the divinity of Jesus was taught to the exclusion of his humanity, so that that he wasn't really one of us. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and I think this is more the modern notion now, is that Jesus is just one of us. And the fallacy of those kinds of things really is that Jesus must be both, because he needs to be God-man. He needs to be the one who is God himself who comes to us. And that's woven throughout the scriptures, you know, this idea where God says, if you understand the big theme of the scripture to be God gathering a people to himself, and then you have the failure of the prophets, you have the failure of the kings, you have the failure of the priests and all that. Finally, in two or three different places, one of them being Jeremiah, says, I myself will come, and I will write the covenant in their heart. And so Jesus becomes the fulfillment of that, but in order to do that, he has to be both. He has to be God and man. And so that's a big piece of our theological thinking that we affirm in the creeds. And the creeds are really, in many ways, the product of working through that big question of Jesus, the God-man, the incarnate Word of God. What does that mean? It means he's very God, or very God begotten, not made. And when you kind of crank that into the suffering thing, which I think kind of started with that, is the idea then that Jesus knows what it means to suffer. And
we have a high priest who can identify with
it. Right, absolutely. And more than identify it, but give it purpose. I think that's one of the places where we as Christian people have something to offer to the world, and that is that suffering has purpose. And that purpose is to bring us, when a person is suffering, eventually they get left alone somewhere. And it's a conversation with God. And you kind of see that in Job. That in the end it came down to Job and God. And then the question becomes then for Job is, you know, not just why, but does this have any meaning at all? And out of it comes the understanding that on Job's part, that God is trustable in his life. No matter what happens, God will care for him, and God cares deeply for him, and will use this to bring him not only closer to him, but also as a witness to the world. So our lives always have bigger meaning than just ourselves. So that's that one passage. You talked about Isaiah. Which one was the one in Isaiah?
Isaiah chapter 57. Verse 1.
Okay. me just pull that up for myself.
And
the righteous man perishes, no one lays it to heart. Devout men are taken away while no one understands. For the righteous man is taken away from calamity. He enters into peace. Yeah, that's just that kind of idea that suffering has purpose in God's hands. It changes who we are, and it teaches us things we would never experience or learn without that experience. And in the end, it leaves us alone with God.
A previous moderator discussed the difference between discipline and punishment,
mm-hmm.
where God talks about he chastens the
mm-hmm.
son that he loves,
mm-hmm.
Where discipline is to preserve the actor,
mm-hmm.
contrasted with punishment to preserve the rule or the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I mention that because that Job 37:13 seems to say to me that sometimes suffering is for correction, and that kind of correlates with the Psalm 107 for me,
mm-hmm.
or for his land, and or for love.
Mm-hmm.
He causes it to happen.
Yes.
Because God is the only one who is God. He allows suffering in his people's lives to correct them, or, you know, sometimes
mm-hmm.
your suffering isn't about you.
That's absolutely true. I mean, that's the story of the blind man in John. You know, the disciples ask, "Who caused this? Who sinned, this man or his parents?" And Jesus says, "Neither. No, don't worry about that. This was to glorify me." You know, so that you're going to see this and believe, and so yeah, you got all those factors in there but in a society, in a culture that is averse to suffering, that thinks everything ought to be fine all the time, then that there needs to be a cure for everything and a fix for everything that's quick, suffering becomes incomprehensible.
Yeah, this is the last thing, and I'll let y'all go. I'm really enjoying the conversation.
Wow, so am I. Really
you know, Stephen Hawking has ALS.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, whenever I look at him or think about him, I think about those four friends that tore up Jesus' roof to put him down
mm-hmm.
in front of him.
Right.
And, you know, his people are charitable.
Mm-hmm.
And no more so in the realm of science,
mm-hmm.
where his assertions would probably be more stringently scrutinized if he were whole.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the fact that he can still talk is attributable to his engineering friends
mm-hmm.
who
yep.
developed technology yep. to enable him to still be viable.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome. It's fun talking to you.
Thank you, Jen.
Have a great day.
You know what I want to know, Pastor?
Yeah.
Nobody remembers the poor guy with the hole in his roof.
Yeah, right. Whatever happened to him? Who fixed that?
I mean, that's, like I've said, isn't it always a great blessing to have Jesus in your home? Well,
yeah, right. Well maybe not.
Yeah,
you know?
It depends.
As Tony would say, Tony Steinberg would say, one of his better lines is, you know, when Jesus starts messing with you, things change. You
that's
know?
Right. 505-780-850 1-800-730-2727 KFUO@KFUO.org. We've got some Bill O'Reilly, we've got some Hugo Chavez, we've got some Pope stuff, everything for a Friday. Stick around. We will be right back. Welcome back. It's the Ask the Pastor program on the Messenger of Good News, Worldwide KFUO. Pastor Paul Haneke is our guest this morning. He serves at Luther Memorial Lutheran Church in Tinton Falls, New Jersey. I'm Roland Lettner. Thanks for being with us. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and KFUO at KFUO.org. And as I mentioned going into the break, Pastor, we even have some Hugo Chavez news. I don't know if you've seen this. It's kicking around on the wires yesterday and today. It says Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was accused of rigging plenty of elections in his day, but his successor thinks he might also have decided another very important vote that took place here recently. According to acting president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, Chavez is now credited with the selection of a South American pope.
Okay. I mean, that reminds me of when I was a kid, and every time something came up, the Russian communist government would say, no, that's not true, we invented that.
Now, yeah. Maduro is quoted as saying, we know that our commander ascended to the heights and is face-to-face with Christ. Something influenced the choice of a South American pope. Some new arrival at Christ's side said to him, well, it seems to us in South America that our time has come. And, of course, Jesus listened to him.
Right, right.
Because, you know, Jesus would have no idea how to make decisions like this.
That's true. It's got to be left to the hands of others.
Now, the footnote to the story is this, that while Chavez's spirit was supposedly busy helping Jesus pick the new leader of the Catholic Church, the acting president received some very bad news about his body because they wanted to treat him sort of like Lenin.
Yeah, right, put him in a glass tomb.
Yeah, stuff him and put him in a glass tomb, that sort of thing. Sadly, though Jesus can take advice from Chavez about who to pick for pope, he can't seem to preserve the body because he's not well enough preserved to put on display anymore.
Ah, okay.
So he'll just have to wait for the resurrection like the rest of us.
Like the rest of us, yeah. That's right. And see what happens to him. You know?
Yeah. Hey, I mentioned Bill O'Reilly. I've been saving a little bit of this audio. It just, you know, it's kind of a fun thing. He took on a fellow by the name of Pastor Jeffers. Jeffers is someone who came to some prominence back during the last election, actually during the Republican primaries, because he made some remarks about Mormonism and Mitt Romney that very quickly, when it became evident that Romney was going to be the Republican nominee, he had to retract because, you know, he wanted to stay sort of, you know, in the know in the politics of the Republican Party. But what I did was I took and I segmented this interview that O'Reilly did with him, and I thought maybe just comment a little bit on O'Reilly's perspective as sort of the, well, theologian-in-chief, at least, of cable TV news.
Right.
We might see what he thinks about things. Check out this first bit, and then we'll talk about it for a little bit. Listen to this.
Okay.
Impact segment tonight, the Bible miniseries, produced by Mark Burnett and his wife, actress Roma Downey. We had him on earlier this week, brought in a record amount of viewers for the History Channel Sunday night. The program highlights fundamentalist Christian beliefs. Joining us now from Dallas, the senior pastor of the First Baptist Church there, Robert Jeffress. So, Pastor, let's begin at the beginning. Adam and Eve.
Okay.
Adam and Eve. Did they literally live in the Garden of Eden and usurp the evolutionary process?
Well, absolutely. They lived. They were actual human beings. And Jesus affirmed that, Bill, in Matthew 19. And so I think Jesus knew what he was talking about.
All right, just give me the affirmation in Matthew 19. Jesus said?
Jesus said that God created man and female in the garden, and he brought them together in marriage.
Okay.
And so Jesus was affirming the fact that there was one man and one woman.
He didn't name Adam and Eve. He just said that God, and Jesus did say that God created the universe.
Well. Well, first of all, I like the word fundamental being thrown in there.
Yes. I mean, you know, Bill O'Reilly's got, you know, he knows everything. I mean, and he kind of puts that out there a lot of times, not only on that, but a lot of other stuff. I tend to watch the first couple of minutes every night. And,
yeah. And Adam and Eve usurped evolution.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, shame on them for that. Don't they know about science?
Right. I mean, it's hard to even comment on that in the sense that, you know, he's got a point of view and he puts it out there and you know, this idea that Adam and Eve are not real people, that this is a story and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's But it's a crucial story. I mean, it shapes our reality. I mean, everything in the scriptures always goes back to that. You know, it's this idea that God created a world which was good and people who lived in fellowship with Him. God walks in the cool of the evening. Key passage. And then you know, they are tempted by their own pride to not usurp evolution, but to usurp the power of God. You will be a god unto yourself. You will decide what is right and what is wrong. And then this creation is shattered. And then God's, the rest of the scripture is about how God is gathering that people back to Himself. I think as you study, at least in my experience, as you kind of listen to people talk and look at philosophy and other world religions and stuff, you know, they all have some kind of a story about creation. They all have some kind of a story about the fall. My point is that the reason they all have it is because there's only one story, and that's the story of the scripture. And then after the Tower of Babel and all that kind of stuff and the scattering of the nations and everything else, people took fragments of that story with them. And then it's just been corrupted through the generations, except by the remnant people of God who have remained His, who He keeps preserving and creating to tell the right story and to be a witness to that story in the world and become the means by which God, in His mercy and grace, is regathering a people to Himself.
Yeah, even the Aboriginal people of Australia have a story about a flood in a big canoe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it seems obvious to me that, you know, but then again, I'm not that bright. But but it seems obvious to me that if everybody's telling a version of the same story, that there must be some reality back there that somebody experienced to bring that forward. So
here's the next little bit. Now, this is typical of what you hear from people today.
Yeah. Now, if you believe in Adam and Eve, there are a number of other things that you have to believe. Incest is one of them, because the race had to procreate off the children that Adam and Eve had. Then have to reject the science of evolution and carbon dating and all of those things. So it's kind of incompatible with science, or am I wrong?
No, I think you're wrong on this one, Bill. You're usually absolutely right, but I think you're wrong on this one. The Bible does not contradict true science. It may contradict the passing fads of scientific theory that are always evolving. For example, it used to be thought that the cosmos always existed, but then we had Sir Frederick Hoyle, who named the Big Bang Theory, that said, guess what? The universe had a beginning 13.7 billion years ago. Again, Frederick Hoyle, a Cambridge mathematician, said the chance of
Do you believe that? Do you believe that the universe started 13.7 billion years ago? Do you?
I think it very well could have been. One of the things that fundamentalist Christians mess up on is they try to say the earth is 6,000 years old. The Bible never makes that claim.
Now, Ken Ham was very cross about that.
Okay.
Yeah, from the Creation Museum.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I don't know, as far as the Pastor Jeffers goes, is he making a fairly good defense?
I think he's right in the sense of saying, when he uses the idea of changes in thinking, you know, that what's in this scientific world in which we live, there's just numerous examples of what is passed off today as the result of science today, that you know that contradicts something that was thought to be universally true 100 years ago. And the same thing will happen in the future. Because knowledge, they just learn more stuff, they do more stuff. And as they do more stuff, it seems to me that from what I read at least, the credibility of the biblical narrative becomes more credible. Maybe not as much as we would like it and all this kind of stuff. But it becomes more, you know, more affirmed. You follow what I'm saying?
I do.
And what is passed off as fact today may not in fact be fact, because 100 years from now or 50 years from now or next Tuesday, it could find out that, well, that's not exactly true.
Well, sure. The press was full of stories 2 days ago about they found the God particle.
Right.
You know, in Geneva, Switzerland with this...
that Hicksfield thing. You know.
Yeah, and then now the reports are, well,
maybe not.
Yeah, it was a particle.
Right.
God may have had something to do with it, but we can't put the two together just yet. Now, this is an important bit here because it's not so much that the Bible has allegory in it, but it's the parts of the Bible you refer to as allegory that makes all the difference. Listen to
this. Absolutely. Yeah.
But you're a smart guy, and I want to take it out of the theological realm. You know the evolutionary theory, and I subscribe, and my belief system is that there is a higher power, and that the evolution was the way he created the world. Now, I was taught in my Catholic school that a lot of the stories in the Bible are allegorical. And for example, there are stories in the Old Testament where you stone people, you have slaves, and obviously Jesus didn't want to stone anyone or have slaves.
I'm not sure. Is O'Reilly saying that those things are allegorical?
Yeah. Ask Stephen how allegorical they are.
Yeah, right. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just. That's part of a world in which these folks lived, and that's what they did.
Well, this is a shining example of human reason.
Yeah. Right.
You know, when he says he believes in a higher power, I think that higher power bears the name Roger Ailes. Creator of the Fox Network.
Well, he's got a good job, you know. I mean,
yes. let's divert from this for a moment and go back to the phones. Talk with James. James, good morning. Okay, Matthew 6:20-23 on your mind.
Yes, I'd like to ask Pastor to compare and contrast those verses with the way a theologian of the liberation theology would do it, and if he could. Kind of explain liberation theology and define it for me.
Okay, I mean, I'm not an expert in liberation theology, but I'll give it a shot. What do we? You said Matthew 6.
Yeah, Matthew 6 verses 20-23.
20-23, which is, if I got it right, but lay up treasures for yourself in heaven.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay,
it's Luke.
Oh,
6.
Luke. Okay, Luke 6. Well,
minor distinction. 20, minor 20, distinction 20. There, yeah.
Luke 6:20. Okay. Blessed are the poor. For you. Okay, the Beatitudes. Yeah. Okay, liberation theology, as I understand it and as I studied it years ago, I mean, it was a notion that came about that the gospel would, in fact, bring about some kind of freedom for people in a material sense. I mean, I think it was a reaction to kind of a spiritualization of the gifts of Christ, where we kept talking about people who were going to be rewarded in heaven, so it didn't really matter much what your life looked like here, and that there was a world order here that in which people had stations and people were poor and all that kind of stuff. And so the impression was given, I think, for many people that one should not mess with the world order, with the way things are. And that sometimes Jesus's remark, the poor will always be with you, was kind of taken out of context and said, well, that means that Jesus affirms the reality of poverty is a good thing. And so liberation theology, especially in the oppressive situations of Latin America, then grew out of a notion of trying to make that then that Jesus was the liberator. I remember when I was in college and seminary in the 60s that you had these Che Guevara shirts, you know, and you had this idea of the champion of the people and all those kinds of things. So that's kind of what that liberation theology is all about, I think. I mean, there's lots of people out there writing about it, and it kind of faded away a little bit, I think, but that's kind of what it was. The gospel would set people free materially and from oppressive regimes. And that may be true, you know, in some cases. Jesus in the Beatitudes is talking about this idea of one standing before God. And I think there's basic questions that we all have to deal with. And one of them is, what is my status in the universe? How do I stand before God? And what is the attitude that I bring to God? And in the particularly in Luke's version of the Beatitudes there, where you have blessed are the poor, yours is the kingdom of heaven. I think he is talking about a poverty of spirit, kind of a brokenness, which in which you can make no demands. Because that's what it means when you are poor. In some sense, you cannot make demands on people because you have nothing, and that translates, I think, into this idea when Luther talks about the idea that we're all beggars before God. We cannot make demands. We stand empty before Him. And then, you know, he goes on, blessed are you when you hunger now, for you shall be satisfied. When you weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and exclude you and revile you, spurn you, your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day. Leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For so their fathers did to the prophets. And so you've got this idea of two things, I think, pop out of that passage. One is our statuses before God, as that of people who can give nothing but can only receive. And then that second part is why does God use us in our poverty as a witness to the world? And so it's through our willingness to stand not only naked before God, but also powerless before the world as witnesses of love, that will eventually result, or it can result, in kind of the persecution and things that would happen. And this happened to the disciples. I mean, this is definitely prophetic in the sense that Jesus is talking to the disciples, and he said, you know, you're gonna experience my love, you're gonna experience the gospel, you're gonna be forgiven, and then you're gonna be thrown into the world. And in the world you will be reviled and hated.
Okay,
you've got those two kinds of things there. It's a little bit of a convoluted answer, but
No, it's been very helpful because we've been over the past few days noticing some things that are coming out about our new pope,
mm-hmm.
our new Holy Father,
mm-hmm.
About him being a social justice pope,
mm-hmm.
and from Argentina, where this liberation theology is very prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we're trying to understand it. So thank you very much, Pastor,
for
that.
Yeah.
Thank you, James. Have a great weekend. Appreciate the phone call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. You know, the whole liberation theology thing,
yeah.
this clash between what is faith, what are politics, what are left-of-center politics,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, what a lot of that brought about was totalitarianism.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't any social liberation.
And then the reaction to it on the part of many conservative Christians or evangelical Christians or whatever was kind of a theological response in which the poor were not cared for. So, I mean, God cares that people are poor, and God cares that people are oppressed. And we are, in fact, people who are freed from things, from sin, death, and the power of the devil, and we are to be useful in the world. You know, I think one of the gifts that Matt Harrison brings to the church is a real keen awareness of ministry of mercy and a real keen awareness of the fact that we need to be good neighbors and we need to be people who, in the name of Jesus, look to people's physical needs.
Yeah, but it's about getting the majors and the minors right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, you don't cure poverty and make this a better world and ignore... This is something, I've mentioned this a couple of times on the program, that just really caught my attention from a couple of weekends ago when I did a Saturday program talking about just war doctrine, and the professor I was interviewing said, you know, there's a big distinction between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the worst thing that can happen to you is you can die. Back then, the worst thing that could happen to you was where you wound up after you died.
Right.
So people weren't so much preoccupied with the death angle of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that was appointed to every man.
Right.
To meet his end, and you were supposed to be more concerned about what came afterwards.
What came after, yeah.
Today we've dismissed that. Today it's all about the here and the now.
Well, I mean, that's you're back to Stephen Hawking. I keep an article on my desk, you know, this idea that says when you ask him, I mean, it's part of the interview that I have for whatever reason, is, you know, what's going to happen to you when you die? And he said, nothing. I'm dead. I'm gone. And I think that view is shared by a fairly large number of people in our world. They do not believe in an afterlife. They don't believe in a heaven or a hell. They just believe that when you die, you die.
And what's sad about that, close to your neighborhood again, you know, the Sandy Hook shooting that took place up there.
Yeah.
There is, I think, some reasoned argument to be made that when you despair, you know, eternal destination, positive and negative, heaven and hell, that there is not eternal consequence for what you do in this life.
Right.
Then people are more prone to do things like that.
Absolutely.
Why do you think they all shoot themselves in the head when they get caught?
Right, they've accomplished whatever it was in their twisted mind that they wanted to accomplish, which is usually fame. They will be remembered, and then that's it.
That's the old ancient Norse idea of immortality, is that your name endures forever. You do great things.
They will sing songs about it.
Right, exactly. It's
really a world in which the universal notions of faith. I think one of the things that Bob Newton points out is that in his presentations about post-church world is that in a churched world, which I certainly grew up in, and spent most of my ministry in, I think, there were certain universal things which were held by a majority of people. And in the post-church world, those things are not held anymore. And one of them is respect for the scriptures, and knowing at least some of the story. And I think you got Bill O'Reilly as a good example of that. I mean, as bright as the guy is, he really doesn't have the story straight.
Well, he's a man of the Enlightenment.
Yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, science norms and types God, not the other way around.
Absolutely. But I mean, I can even deal with that if they at least get the literature straight, you know.
Good point.
Then you can talk. You know, if we're all reading the same story and it's Tuesday everywhere, then you can talk about that stuff. But when somebody doesn't even know the basic story, it's hard to talk with that. So I mean, so the story disappeared. Where did I learned Bible stories not only in, as a kid, I'm 66, so I learned Bible stories not only in my church, I also learned them in public school.
Yeah, so did I.
Because they were taught as literature. You know, it was thought that a well-rounded individual living in that culture, if they were going to be able to converse intelligently and if they were going to be able to function in the society, you had to know a couple of Bible stories. You just did. You had to know about the Good Samaritan and the prodigal son. And it's always scary when they do these interviews and they start asking people about that stuff. I have no clue whatsoever.
Well, just classical literature.
Yeah, I mean, it's the dumbing down of America. Daniel Pat Moynihan used to talk about, you know, so.
Yeah, slouching towards Gomorrah was another one of those
yeah,
words,
it's crazy, you know. It's crazy. But that's the world we got. And that's the opportunity that we have to be a witness in that world.
Now, you think people in a world like that would be hungry for the gospel?
Yeah, I think they are. Once you get them, once they're convinced that you're not doing it just for yourself. That's what makes some of these mercy things that we do so important. You know, when somebody comes in or somebody with a need or big things, little things, if they are treated with love and compassion and usefulness, you know, that's the James thing, you know.
Yeah.
I think they are ready to hear an alternative way to live. You know, and they're ready to hear that they will know that God cares about them because we do. You know, I mean, it's just basic stuff.
Well, you know, there's a little bit of a backlash. You know, got a story in front of me here from the North Carolina General Assembly where they're trying to pass a bill right now that would allow the Bible, again, to be taught as literature, you know, in public schools. Not the best of all things, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
Well, yeah, it is. And it should be. There's no doubt in my mind it should be, and it's because I do believe, as a person, that to be a well-rounded person, I think you need to know a lot of this stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
Pastor Paul Honig, he's been our guest in this segment of Ask the Pastor from Luther Memorial Lutheran Church in Tinton Falls, New Jersey. All our best, sir. Thank you. Give our greetings to the Reverend Dr. Steinbrunn the next time you see him.
I certainly will. It's been my pleasure to talk with you, and stay in touch.
We shall. Thank you. Well, guys, there it is. I hope we provided a service for Christ and His church and for you, our listeners. Thanks. We'll see you Monday in the Bible study. Bye-bye.
Listen to the Bible study Monday through Friday at this same time. The Bible study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download archives at kfuo.org. The Bible study is heard weekdays on KFUO Radio, a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.